Hey, this is Future Thinkers, where we talk about how to adapt to a changing world, build more resilience, upgrade culture and society, and create meaning and purpose. With your hosts, Mike Gilliland and Yuvi Ivanova.
Hey everyone, today we have Joe Brewer on the show again as part of our regenerative series. We had Joe on the show last year, talked about cultural evolution and designing regenerative cultures. Since then, Joe moved to a rural community in Colombia and started the Earth Regenerators Study Group and wrote a new book.
In this episode, we talk about his new book called The Design Pathway for Regenerating Earth. We also talk about what it's like to live in economic collapse, how to reestablish relationships with nature and community, and how something as important as earth regeneration can be done with a sense of childlike playfulness. To see the full version of this interview, become a member at futurethinkers.org/members. And for all the links and show notes, go to futurethinkers.org/126. Now let's get into this episode.
We just finished a great meditation workshop with John Vervaeke, where he guided our members through finding their center, their root, their flow, and their focus. The recording of the workshop is now available in the members area. We have another workshop coming up too with a meditation teacher named Michael Taft. We've also had him on the show previously. This one's going to be about generating archetypal mind states, which is a really useful skill to have in times of global transition. To find out more and to sign up, go to futurethinkers.org/Taft, T-A-F-T.
Welcome back to the show, Joe. It's really good to have you again. We always have such great conversations with you. We had a Q&A with you on our show recently, and then we did a podcast interview a little while ago. So for anybody listening who missed those, we'll put links in the show notes. But today we want to focus on talking about the pathways to regenerating the earth. So the specific things that are working when it comes to creating regenerative communities, bioregions, groups of people, projects, sort of all aspects of regeneration from a practical standpoint, which you've been embedded in Colombia for the last little while. So I'd like to hear you talk about that and also the book that you've recently published.
Yeah. Let me start by saying that the name of my book is The Design Pathway for Regenerating Earth. And I use the word "the" on purpose because in my own journey, I've become convinced that there is only one. There's only one pathway. And the shorthand version of that pathway is we have to create economies that function like living systems that are organized locally around local landscapes. And this naturally emerges as bioregional economies. And if we do that all over the planet, then we can regenerate the entire planet. And so this is, you know, the kind of Cliff Notes version in 30 seconds. And our family moved to Colombia back in November last year, so only about 7 months ago, and we've come a long way in connecting to a set of patterns and activities that are enabling us to practice this design pathway, to walk it with people here locally. And I'm really excited to talk about that with you today.
Cool. Amazing. So what has been your journey like? What are some of the kind of hard lessons that you've learned?
One hard lesson that we've learned is that, and this is one that I think a lot of people are familiar with, is if people who are taking lead roles that you need to collaborate with, if they have problems with money, either under financial stress to keep their organization going or something like this, that you're pretty much guaranteed to fail at collaborating with them. That I've had a long history of really great ideas, really great intellectual connection and resonance, and really bad integration in practice, meaning very poor cooperation, where financial strain is an issue. And that's a really big challenge that we've seen over and over again. And another thing is that when there's a need for transformational change and the system is still functioning, you can't transform it. So there's this paradox that you have to wait until a system is in collapse and then be ready in the midst of the chaos and confusion to create support pathways for transformation. And that's exactly what's happening right now where we live in Barichara in Colombia, because the COVID pandemic back in March, when they locked down the town to stop the spread of the virus. And by the way, there are zero cases of the virus in Barichara. There has not been a single case in the entire 4 months, but 80% of the local economy comes from tourism. So when they locked down the town, the economy died in a week. In 1 week, it went from a thriving economy to a dead economy. And in the midst of that crisis and collapse is where this transformational pathway is emerging now. And so this is a really important lesson at all scales of regeneration. But it's one that we're discovering the beauty of right now. But beforehand, we would have been scared, like, oh, to think of an economic collapse, that sounds terrible. And it is really hard for a lot of people, but it's in that space that we're able to guide and direct change. So that's a really important lesson that I'd love to unpack further with you today.
So in that space where the economy collapsed, what emerged first? And what are some of the things that emerged a little later? It's interesting to notice that, because I'm thinking about growing up in Soviet Union, when that collapsed, the things that emerged first were not necessarily healthy. But then there are things that emerged later that were better adapted. So that's why I'm curious about that.
Yeah, one thing about being in Latin America and in the year 2020 is everyone has smartphones and everyone has WhatsApp. And so what happened within the first 4 or 5 days was several WhatsApp groups were created and a lot of community members joined them. One of them was called Support of the Local Economy, so Apoyo Economia. Another one was for community resilience. And another one was for organizing efforts around resilience. So sort of a group of organizers formed a group. And a group was created for discussing how to build resilience. And the group of organizers started mapping what was happening based on what they already knew. So some of them had been working with food systems and solidarity relationships with farmers. Others had been working on water security. And so, like, previously there had been other activities. They just organized very quickly. And within maybe 2 weeks or a little more than 2 weeks, they had created a solidarity food where 10 farms were delivering food. You know, what we would call in the U.S., we'd call it community-supported agriculture. Here they call it Mercado de Solidaridad, a solidarity market. But they created this food exchange between about 20 families in the town and about 10 farms in the surrounding countryside to deliver food to people's homes. And so this sort of rapid structuring of solidarity relationships was a key thing that happened within weeks. It was like almost instant. Another thing that happened was the ability to control and regulate things, which Colombia has a long history of violence from its government. So the ability to control things felt strong. Like, everyone was afraid to go outside and they didn't want the police to catch them. So, you know, because they didn't want to pay penalties or go to jail because of the virus, and fear spread across the community. But it was really easy to discover how weak the enforcement was. So, like, an example in my own family, we would break the rules by sneaking out at night with a bucket of compost and my 3-year-old daughter and go to the community food forest to do composting. So we're doing guerrilla gardening. And of course, there's no surveillance because there are like 5 cops in this town of 5,000 people and everyone's overwhelmed. So it's easy to go around the rules and find the space in between. And so there were a lot of people gathering at night to plan for resilience. They were also being mindful of not spreading the virus, because in the first few weeks, we didn't know if it was in the town or not. And so there was this kind of mix of people paralyzed by fear, a story of really strong enforcement from the government, and a discovery of blank spots where those institutions just don't exist. So we could find a fluid motion. And the people here the campesinos in Colombia are very good at finding that place after what was basically a 50-year civil war. So they're very good at going around the militarized enforcement. So all these things were happening in a very confusing way in the first few weeks.
Was there some sort of an equilibrium that was reached eventually, or is it still changing?
Yeah, there was a pattern that arose for about 2.5 months where those of us who think systemically from like day one, we're saying, wait, the rainy season's about to start and we have a water scarcity problem and everyone has to stay indoors. How can we organize work parties to build water retention systems? And so after 2 months of feeling that way with no action, what happened was most of the town, just everyone sort of in the rumor mill, started complaining and being afraid, what are we going to do about water? But no action. So there was this sort of normalcy within the chaos that arose, but it was a collective paralysis. And what began to happen, and my family was leading this within our own set of families that we're friends with, was another parallel thing, is kids below the age of 6 were strictly forbidden from leaving the house under any condition. And up to this day, children are not allowed out of the house below the age of 6. So parents have started finding ways to meet with their neighbors who have kids that are friends, because it's extremely unhealthy to isolate children and keep them in their homes for multiple months. So we started meeting with our neighbors who also have a 3-year-old daughter. And by hanging out together while our kids played, we started thinking about things we could do. And we, after a little while, started going and digging ponds and canals and things to catch the water because the rain started to come. And so what we started to see was a self-organized action within families connected to land, because we had this community food forest that we could walk to from our house without the police seeing us. And actually, my daughter and I got caught by the police. If you can imagine our 3-year-old daughter being documented and they're taking photos as we're taking compost to this food forest. It's sort of hilarious. We're going to have great stories to tell when she's an adult. But these sort of patterns of the old system being weak and the self-organizing pattern of people taking action is what began to happen.
And so where do you think is the momentum going now? Because whenever there's this break in the old system, you know, the flow of energy redirects. So where do you feel that's going now?
It's going in two directions, and we don't know which one is going to win. One direction is that we have a pretty incompetent mayor, and the previous mayor of the town was deeply corrupt and actually sent to prison. And so there's sort of a history that the government is either inept or corrupt. And there's a water crisis where the mayor is saying, let's just dig deeper wells, which would destroy the aquifers that are already damaged. So there's this story of incompetence and poorly thought out action. And we could default into water privatization and destruction of the aquifers, which is related to food security issues and other things. This sort of lack of imagination and lack of empowerment to transform things. And there's a lot of inertia for that. At the same time, there is a pattern organizing among several of us. And I want to be careful that it doesn't sound like I'm leading all this organizing, because my family is still mostly outsiders. We've only lived here for 7 months. Most of the organizing is local people, Colombians from the town, that are doing a lot of this work. We just are becoming friends with them and starting to get involved. But for example, last week, a community water commission was created with the blessing of the mayor's office. But the mayor's office doesn't have any money, doesn't have any staff resourcing. So there's this community group working on water that now has sort of the permission from the mayor to do work with the city, which allows the city to start to build a story of competence, while this committee is a group of people who really know systemic water issues. So they are like doing permaculture, water retention systems, agroforestry and agroecology, working with 15 farms, like really good work. And so we have this potential right now for this set of solutions that they've been developing, these people on their farms, to showcase them and replicate them across the entire landscape. And so we're moving into a place of potential for regenerating the entire territory.
Very cool.
Yeah. Let's come back to the point of the pathway as you called it, to regenerating the earth. How is that happening or not happening in Bhattacharya?
One way that it's like very close to happening is after tourism collapsed. If you ride your bike down the highway or walk on any of the trails, you'll see for sale signs on all of the farms. Because all these local people, campesinos with very little money, and the small amount of income they got from tourism is now gone, and they're considering selling their land. But no one is going to buy the land. And you know, no one is coming in with money. Although with the Earth Regenerators study group that we have, I'm going to start to develop a project to try to raise money and collectively buy land. But that's something we can talk about in a moment related to the Earth Regeneration Fund and things you and I talked about before to start to enact some of that model. But at the same time, tourism is stopped for at least a year and possibly forever. So like the schools have been shut down for all of the elementary school kids and the high schoolers since March, and it won't come back on until at least next spring. So kids are just sitting at home playing video games, stuck in their houses while we're in the middle of this planetary crisis. And so there's this interesting possibility to go and talk to the owners of these farms and create solidarity relationships, build cooperative models with them. And for example, instead of buying the land from them, offer to buy the land with them and say, you know, what would you need for us to create 5 years of security for your family if we can find some money from the outside that allows us to implement agroforestry, land regeneration on your property while we're building the new economy? Because tourism may not come back. And if tourism does come back, everything we're going to do is going to be fantastic tourism stories and educational opportunities. And so we're in this place where I think people that don't have an imagination of what to do are open to those conversations. And so during this opening is our chance. And we've probably only got a few months before people will just start leaving, or they'll become so paralyzed with fear that they will cling to the old way, almost like an addiction, and we won't be able to talk to them. And so we have this window of time to work in to put ourselves on the new pathway.
So I'd love to hear you expand more on the design pathway. And also, I would like to bring this back into the West a little bit, just because that's where our audience is. How does this apply? Where are the models the same and different in the West?
Yeah, the most important thing for all of this is to create material flows in our supply chains that are local. So a relocalization of economies, which has been happening all over the West, like at farmers markets, for example, all of the ways that people buy local, and how tourism is actually based on, you know, this is the town where there's this type of art that makes baskets or a type of food or whatever. So all of that is part of this work. And that's something I think everyone can identify with in the West. But another piece that's going to be really important is to connect with indigenous lifeways. Now, where you guys are in Canada, that's not so hard to do because a number of First Nations groups in Western Canada are still there. And you can go back and look at their ways of living. Where we are in the Andes, the indigenous people were exterminated 500 years ago. And so we have this interesting challenge of a lot of existing indigenous groups in the Andes, but the ones that used to live here are gone. And so I think this is something a lot of people can relate to as well, is how do we connect to the history of the place where we live? And that's the more general question everyone can relate to. How was this land sustainable by some people in the past? And how do we recreate that for where we are now? And so for like regional scale agriculture, you can see in like in the area where you guys live, I know that just a little south of you in Idaho, there was a way of growing a type of tuber, a type of potato, that they were growing in the marshes and in the lakes. And I'm sure you could do some of that, that's more in the Cascades, but you could find some of that in the Rockies too, of ways of growing food in the kind of the rain shed of mountains on the western side of the mountain ranges that are indigenous ways of growing So there's this question of how to connect to that. Another thing I think is really important is ownership of land, which I think that, you know, getting back to what is the design pathway. Part of the design pathway is to create patterns of integration and cooperation that work at the scale of landscapes. So working for an entire watershed, an entire mountain range, an entire fishery, that we need to organize human management around the landscapes. And one of the problems is private land creates barriers to coordination at larger scales. You know, you got the tragedy of the commons of incentives being aligned around private land when you need incentives aligned around landscapes. Mm. And this is a real challenge for a lot of people. And it's a real challenge for us here in Colombia too. So this is just a big problem. And the design pathway becomes how do we see the patterns of living systems in our landscapes? And then how do we make our economies as much as possible around supporting the development of those living systems? It's like, how does water flow through a landscape? And how do we build soils in the landscape and things like this? And then from this, we start to see the more information economy. Like, where do people have knowledge around how to process specific local plants to make natural fibers for clothing or for medicine, food? And then you can get a very complex cuisine where people travel to your region to eat special kinds of foods that local people really know how to make. Like when I go to the Northwest and I want to eat salmon, because salmon of the Northwest is phenomenal and regional. So there's a lot of this sort of stuff that is really important. But then there's also the piece of what does it mean to no longer be part of a globalized economy that is able to extract from a region and degrade it in service to private wealth hoarding somewhere else on the planet, which we can see in all of our economic systems is a big problem. So these are a few pieces I'm sort of talking around that are related to this work. But that's something I think we can all relate to, is how do we solve these problems from one place to another as we struggle with it together?
Yeah, the interesting thing about this is that there's no one-size-fits-all model, because, you know, right now, if you go into a store, a food store, anywhere in Canada, the things available are going to be more or less the same. And a lot of them don't even come from here because, you know, the vegetables that are in store right now come from Mexico or United States. And so the things that actually grow locally are downplayed because it's not... doesn't fit the economies of scale, so it might not be profitable under the current economic model to produce those things locally. So it's interesting what it looks like to rediscover those things, those local plants, local fibers, you know, the things that make sense to produce, even the types of energy, like is it solar, is it hydro, is it something else, is it wind? The things that make sense locally are going to be different. And so it's going to be very interesting to see those different flavors of local economies emerging. And it's interesting because some of those things will apply kind of at a meta level to other places, and we can all learn from each other. But there are a lot of things that will have to be figured out in a way from scratch, or we'll have to look into the past, how they were done. And it's a unique challenge, I think.
Yeah, the way I see it is there is a shared way of thinking about design, but this way of thinking about design includes contextualization. So you contextualize the design to the context you're designing for. So you can have at the meta level, the design is about contextualization, and that's universal, but contextualization is about the specific. So that's a piece. Another piece is, and I just gave a webinar about this last weekend, we can actually design for climate change in a positive way, is we can reverse the harmful kinds of climate change at the regional scale. So where we're living in Colombia, it's a place that's becoming a desert. And in the past, it was a tropical dry forest. So if we want to bring back the tropical dry forest, we are designing climate change because we're designing away from becoming a desert. And so this is like sort of like a little mind fuck. You're like, wait a second. I thought climate change was bad if humans caused it. But here we're talking about intentionally changing climate, geoengineering and all this stuff, except it's not geoengineering, it's geobiomimicry. It's collaborating with living systems as part of the design thinking, right? It's not a machine metaphor, which is what engineering is. But again, that's a universal for every place. We're designing for biomimicry. We're changing the climate for the living systems of that region, meaning we're trying to either restore a previous climate or prepare the human economy for the changed climate that's coming. And so in either case, we're designing for climate change.
Get our 50-page guide on adapting to the future. Sign up at futurethinkers.org/signup.
The brand new Future Thinkers members portal is now live. Develop your sovereignty and self-knowledge with our in-depth courses, get access to our weekly sense-making calls, join the Q&As with past podcast guests, and much more. Become a Future Thinkers member today at futurethinkers.org/members.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought in biomimicry, because as you were saying that, I was just thinking about our conversation with Dana Baumeister on our podcast, where she talked about the principle of biomimicry, and that there's only one principle. It's that life creates conditions that are conducive for life, and we need to organize everything around that same thing. So what is the thing that we're doing that creates condition for life, for things to grow and thrive and be healthy? And it's on all levels, you know, on individual level, family level, community level, economic level. It all has to be organized around that. And there's no other way. Eventually, things become extinctionary if we don't organize them around that.
You know, to add to that, something that's surprised me lately in my own thinking is how little kind of collaborative thinking goes into, you know, kind of building what you want to build. Like if you want to live out in nature or you want to do some project, like it's the automatic thought process, having grown up here, is that I have to raise the funds for myself to do my own thing in a closed off environment. And there, like now that we're building this project in BC, we're involving a lot of other people, and it's suddenly like everyone's kind of realizing all at once, wow, this is really a lot easier doing this as a community than it is doing it as individuals. Like funding is not a question. It's not even a problem really when you have so many people getting involved in a project on a larger region. So, you know, my question goes to that. What kind of changes in thinking do you think are going to be necessary? And what's going to change about people's lifestyles and ways of thinking?
One of the most important changes in thinking is going from thinking about a person who resides in a place to thinking about being a person who lives in a place. And we think, if you go back to your grandparents, my grandparents, they lived somewhere. Whereas in our generation, you know, when we were like in high school, we were looking forward to going to college and getting away from where we were, and then trying to find a place that would be like, well, I really want to live in this kind of climate or this kind of city and have this kind of job. And without knowing it, we were trying to be residents instead of inhabitants. And this is a really important difference. Another deep way of a change in thinking is the joy of playing with life rather than the drudgery of working with death. So that most of us do like life-destroying, soul-crushing work that makes us feel dead inside. And so we work with death, and then we like need to go on vacation to recuperate or do other things too, because it destroys us. But when you're playing with life, I'll give an example in a moment. But when you're playing with life, what happens is you become a kid again. And I've been around two little three-year-old girls that are giggling all the time, and it's contagious to watch little kids play. It's like you feel alive by playing with life. So my example is this. We've been digging these canals and little like ponds for catching water when the rains come. And a couple of days ago, we had friends over for lunch, 8 people in our kitchen. We're all eating together. And as all the plates are being put on the table to eat, the rain got heavy enough that one of my canals was going to have water flowing in it. So I needed to go grab my pickaxe and say, sorry, everyone, stay at my house and eat food, but I'm out of here. And I ran out into the rain to go and look at my canal to see if the water was flowing in it. Well, I was like a kid playing in a sandbox. And I, like, that was my energy. I was a kid playing in a sandbox. But the work was, I was collaborating with the flow of water into a landscape. And so this feeling is so different. As we're healing land, it's so different. And most of us will have recollections of it, like sometimes we felt it, but it was fleeting. And we didn't know we could have it all the time. And so this regenerative work is amazing for this. And it's a really big difference in our thinking.
This is a really important point that you bring up that I was just thinking about a lot in the last couple of days, that regeneration is all about relationship. That the way we think about doing business or doing economy or doing things, we do things to nature. Like, I'm going to go and plant this garden, and it's like a will that I'm imposing onto nature. Like, you stay like this. This is my gardening bed. This is where I'm putting the plants. Instead, we need to think about it like, I'm in relationship with what is happening here. I'm in relationship with the plants. I'm in relationship with the rain and the water flow. I'm in relationship with the climate. And thinking about it as a reciprocal thing, because nature has agency too. Like, those plants want to do something, and working with that rather than, you know, just thinking of you being the only agent in this interaction.
You know, what else is interesting about this is it seems to give kind of a natural or nature embedded purpose into our lives to recognize where we can help and aid with the agency of nature by spreading seeds and creating the ideal conditions for life and kind of working with things over time. Like, you know, people who listen to this show are probably asking themselves the question, why am I here? What am I doing? Fairly often. And I've only recently been getting the experience of, like, working with my hands, finally getting away from the screen, doing some things in real life. And that in itself has made me feel like there's a big chunk of life that's just missing. Like there's stuff we're supposed to do that we've evolved to do that most of us don't get a chance to do. And it's the same thing as, like, becoming a parent. Like, there's this purpose in doing what we're naturally built to do that eases tension and eases stress and makes you, like, eases up that kind of existential dread, because you know you're doing a thing you're meant to be doing.
You're in line with life. You're creating conditions that are producing life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I want to show an example of this. So this bowl right here, these are balls of clay gathered from the clay here, and they have seeds from native plants that my wife and some of the other women in town have identified. And we made these balls of clay. They're called seed bombs. It's one of the names for them. And what this is, and it has some compost in it and some spices that are natural repellents to insects and birds so that they don't eat the seeds. And the idea of this is, we want to help these native plants in our desert environment. So we're just going to take these seed balls. You can see we have a bunch of them. And we're just going to spread them out across the landscape, and they will sit there for months waiting for the rain. When the rain comes, it's going to melt this clay and plant a little seed bomb. And some of these are going to turn into trees and bushes. So this is an example, right?
This is so funny.
This is a way of reversing deserts, right?
Yeah.
Well, first of all, that looked like cookies, and there's no way that I wouldn't be at your house and grab one of those and eat them. And then the other thing is that the other day we were kind of brainstorming what type of, like, group activities we could have on the land once we've acquired it. And airsoft was one thing. I was like, you know what? There's just such a need for physical activity and contest and teamwork and communication and strategizing and stuff. And, like, those kind of war games are so archetypal to masculine warrior kind of energy, which is also something that's not really given an outlet in modern life. So we were like, man, that would be awesome to have airsoft there. I was like, except the pellets probably pollute a lot. I mean, they gather over time. So I looked up, is there such a thing as, like, biodegradable airsoft pellets? And there is. And then my next question was, can we seed these pellets?
Can we put
so
seeds
that our
in
war
the pellets
creates life on the land?
I just love that idea. We were laughing about that.
Yeah, we thought about 3D printing little seed bombs that are airsoft pellets. And so as you're, you know, shooting stuff, you're planting seeds.
Yeah. And so it's just an example of, you see how much we're co-creating with life. What we're doing is we're giving the native plants, we're giving them an advantage in an environment where the seeds would be exposed to the sun because there's no longer forest to cover them and give them shade. All the forest was cut down about 50 years ago. And so in this place, we need a way of protecting the seeds because humans messed it up. Humans took away the protection that seeds naturally had. And so in an environment like this, we need to be very creative at finding solutions to let nature do what it would have done if we hadn't messed it up. And so these clay pellets full of seeds, which is called the Fukuoma method, it was developed by a Japanese farmer and has been demonstrated in Africa and a few other places that this works. We're going to experiment with it here. But you can see how much fun it is for kids to play with clay. I mean, clay is like how you make ceramics. It's how you make mud. Like, actually, our shower got clogged while we were doing this project because we had 6 kids, all of them painted. They all took off their clothes, running around naked, painting their bodies with clay. And then when they jumped in the shower to rinse off, they clogged our shower drain. And so, like, this is how much fun it was to make these clay pellets. So you know, it's just a totally different way of thinking.
Yeah, I really like also this play aspect and involving children in it, because rather than them feeling like this is a serious thing, you know, we have to regenerate the landscape and we're, you know, trying to work with climate change and this is a serious and solemn thing, it becomes play, it becomes fun, it becomes exciting, and then they start being creative with it, like, oh, what if we do this? What if we do this? They participate with it. It's again that relationship, the participating with nature and with each other.
Yeah, our daughter and her friend, every time we see them by themselves, they're like sitting with piles of rocks making canals and ponds and building mountains because they see the adults making these water retention systems. So for them, it's just play. But what we're actually doing is helping them rehearse land regeneration, which, you know, we talked about this in one of our previous discussions. That parenting for regeneration is one of the most important jobs right now, making it normal for kids to feel like adults just regenerate land. And this is a perfect example. 3-year-old kids making ponds, you know, making little canals and ponds to retain water because we're in a desert environment where we need to retain water. You know, it's like, of course, that's part of regenerative parenting. And the kids will just do it because we're making it fun.
You know, it reminds me of that conversation, actually, the idea that this kind of lifestyle also builds personal resilience in people. And like the almost like the Western or I guess kind of liberal attitude is that we are fragile and we must be protected and we must be sheltered from any of these kind of external negative influences. And I like that this thing, this way of thinking, this design pathway that you're talking about puts people out in nature, exposes them more, and also demonstrates to them that they're not fragile, that they can actually grow and benefit from exposure.
Yeah, actually, this is a really important element, which is how do humans become part of the landscape? And I've even come up with a somewhat poetic way of describing it. That all we are is animated dust that is dancing with water. So what it means to be alive, right, is minerals from the Earth's crust that have been dynamically developed with water, with membranes for all of the cells in our bodies. So we are water dancing with dust. And so you start to feel that. So it's no longer just a metaphor, but as a way of being. What it means is that, like, you have dirt under your fingernails because I was picking grass this morning in a place where there's a transition happening in the forest ecosystem. Bushes are coming back, but there was grassland before. So we're pulling the grass between the bushes to give the bushes an acceleration. So it becomes more forest-like. Then I end up with the dust under my fingers. I get dirty. I get calluses, you know, and bumps and scrapes, but I feel good about it. And so this relationship is, again, it's just so invigorating once you start to do it.
And this is how we restore our microbiome as well, because we are meant to be interacting with nature and with dirt and plants and animals all the time. But instead, we sit in these boxes where we're isolated from the elements. And it's no wonder our gut microbiome is unhealthy and that we have to, you know, then take all this stuff to try to fix it, which even makes it worse. Instead, we just need to go out and into the dirt and, you know, restore it that way. Again, through restoring our relationship with nature. Everything is connected.
Yeah. And another thing that's really interesting about that is how much we've normalized being unhealthy. So my wife had a history of hormonal issues of various kinds that she didn't necessarily know were related to hormones. But, you know, when she was younger, she took birth control pills and they did different things to her body. And as you know, having been pregnant and had a child, like the reproductive system of a woman is incredibly complex, how all the hormones interact with each other. So the imbalances can be subtle and chronic. And so what happened was when we moved away from the U.S. and lived in the forest in Costa Rica, and we got away from all the synthetic fabrics in our homes, my wife's libido and her monthly cycle, her menstrual cycle, started to normalize. Well, she's never in her life had a normal menstrual cycle. She's always had, you know, she's one of those women who's always had an irregular cycle. And we hadn't quite put it together that it might be synthetic fibers in the furniture in our houses, and the carpeting, and the paint, and all the electrical infrastructure. Right? Like, we can't say what the causes were because there are too many. There's so many synthetic chemicals that we're constantly exposed to. But when we lived in a simple tiny house in a rainforest, after a few months, her body was detoxing. And so it's just really like this regenerative health aspect is incredibly complex to figure out how it all works. But we've normalized sickness to such an extent that women have hormonal problems. We have all these jokes about women's hormones, but think about environmental toxicology, how messed up women's bodies are because of this. And it's normalized.
Yeah.
Huge deal.
This is one reason I like the idea of having kind of biodomes, geodesic domes, and kind of integrating nature into your normal living space. Like, and the sort of insulation, like we're looking for insulation when we build houses. We want to be insulated from weather and from the elements. But this brings in a lot of those elements into the space while not exposing you to a lot of cold and wetness and stuff. So you can have streams running through your living room, or you can have plants around the perimeter of a dome and really be breathing air directly from the plants and be integrated with it without the downsides.
And you can have glass panels or, you know, some sort
of the sun exposure.
See-through panels so that you get more sunshine, you know, sitting in the dark all the time.
Yeah,
this point about hormonal imbalances, it's not just your physical health, because everything is connected, you know. What I found for me is that my sense-making was affected when I was on IUD, which is like an implant that has little bits of hormones that it releases over several years. And it actually fucked up my sense-making. Like, I was thinking differently. I was not the same person mentally. And then when I went off of it to, you know, to try to have a baby, it was a huge transformation. It was really intense. I was like, holy shit, this is what it feels like to be a woman, actually. And because these hormones, they keep you, at least this particular one, it keeps you basically at a pre-adolescent level of hormones. So here I was, a woman in my late 20s with pre-adolescent level of hormones. It made me unable to access certain levels of wisdom. Like that's crazy. Yeah.
Can you expand that? Like what did you feel like you got access to?
Like being more connected with the actual properly functioning reproductive system realigned me to be more in tune with life and what creates those conditions that are conducive to life, not only for my own health, but also for the health of systems, family, relationships, economy. It was on a very meta level for me. It rippled out. Yeah, I don't know how to describe it.
There's something really important about like age appropriate development. Like when you're in your late 20s, you should be an adult. And so you should feel like and function like an adult. And when you're in your 50s or your 60s, you should start to feel like an elder. And there are developmental stages that are age appropriate. And there are a whole bunch of ways that consumer marketing has stunted or altered this human development pathway. And so it's really interesting, like where we are doing this work on landscape regeneration, one of the most important pieces is the elders. There are these people who have been here for 30 years or longer, who know a lot about how things used to be, and they have a lot of wisdom in the ways that they live their lives, very simple wisdom, but they don't feel empowered to connect with young people who would be doing a lot of the manual labor part. So when we talk about landscape regeneration, it's easy to imagine someone like with a hoe or with a pickaxe or whatever, like physically out there in the field doing work. But some of the most important work is relationship work. And a lot of that relationship work is done by the elders. Like, for example, if I'm out working in the field, there might be a 60-year-old woman who loves playing with kids that's playing with my daughter while I'm doing a little work. And so there are lots of ways that this relationship work, which is extremely important, is being done. And that's very age appropriate for elders.
It's funny, too, because there's so many parts of that relationship that are broken at a cultural level that, like, just an example, you know, Yuvi and I are scouting the properties and trying to build this regenerative center. And we've been talking with my parents quite a lot because they want to be involved and work on the land. And, you know, there's kind of this broken dynamic of how information is shared and how wisdom is shared. In that, like, I don't think, and I don't mean to throw them under the bus, but I don't think there is that kind of like understanding that we lack experience that they have, and that there's a need for that exchange, and that they could step into that role. At the moment, it seems more atomized. Like, it seems more just kind of standard fare, capitalist, Western way of thinking. My castle, my corner, stay out of it. And that you can see it enter into family life as well, not just like our family and other families. It's also like compartmentalization and atomization within the family unit itself, where it's like, I don't want to do that stuff. Like, I don't want to be part of that physical labor, but we're like, we're not asking for that. We're asking for wisdom. You know, we want participation. We want wisdom in that sense that we don't have access to. Yeah. So there's like, I don't know if it's incentives or culture or a combination of a lot of things, but it's hard for our generation to connect to the wisdom of older generations. And I think it's a pretty big cultural basis for that.
Yeah, it's a big issue. And, you know, getting back to the idea of regeneration at a territorial scale, one thing that happens when you go to the scale of an entire landscape, so this is sort of contrasted with something like an eco-village, where you try to take a group of people that are like-minded and go off to create a community together. And here we're talking about there's an extended network of different kinds of people with different subcultures spread across the landscape. And in this kind of a context, what gets really interesting is to look at the functional dependencies where these different subcultures depend on each other, but it may not be conscious. So like where we are, there are these campesino farmers and they depend on their food being bought by people in town. So you have a lot of like functional relationships. But when you get to the ethics or the social aspects of those relationships, there's a lot of opportunity to do things like house parties. You like invite everyone over for Sunday brunch and talk and just build relationships. Or have a big party and play some music and have some beer and get to know each other. And these things that are actually super important to do because they're underdeveloped. They're not as developed as they need to be to have the capacities we need for them. And what's interesting is how much that work is actually, again, it's enjoyable.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah, when I think of like business relationships, they've always come from big parties, ridiculous parties. Like the best kind of deals and relationships have always come from that, when we got to know each other and we're let the guard down.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm walking across the room to show you my magic elixir. This right here is a 4-liter bottle of ginger beer that I ferment from yeast that's in the air with sugar, water, and grated ginger.
Nice.
And that is my elixir for healing community, because it's delicious. It'll get you tipsy and everyone wants to try it. And so as I'm making ginger beer and inviting people over to help make it and help drink it, I'm building community.
That was it for this part of our interview with Joe Brewer. To access the full version, go to futurethinkers.org/members and sign up. And to find all the links and show notes from this episode, go to futurethinkers.org/126. To hear our previous episode with Joe, go to futurethinkers.org/90.
If you like this content, you might want to check out our 7 Ways to Adapt to the Future guidebook. Get it for free at futurethinkers.org/signup. You might also want to check out our Future Thinkers membership area. We have courses there to help you adapt to the changing world, build resilience, upgrade culture and society, and create meaning and purpose in your life. As well, you'll get access to our community, all of our unreleased content, private Zoom calls, live Q&As with guests, workshops and events, and more. Just go to members.futurethinkers.org. Every month we run a contest where we give away 1 month of the Future Thinkers membership for free. Check that out at futurethinkers.org/giveaway. And if you enjoyed this video, please like, share, and comment. It really helps out our show more than you know. And if you want more like it, then subscribe and hit that bell icon to be notified of new videos. See you next time.